Hello, thanks for coming. I'm Ricardo Soler, and I'll be presenting my dissertation this month. It's titled Improving Cashless in Consolidated Environments. So the memory system that is CPU cached, DRAM, and disk is the subsystem in charge of providing instructions and data to the computer processor. And it turns out that the way this modern computers are manufactured, in order to maximize the performance of a computer, we need to equalize the performance of the processor to the performance of the memory. And I like to see this with the following analogy. Let's say the processor is working in a production lane, and the lane is the memory. So the thing here is that the processor can work as fast as it can. It can even start working on twice at a time, can preface, can ask his coworker buddy to help him, but at the end, the work is limited by the speed of the memory, that is the production lane in this case. That's what happens with modern computer systems. We are limited by the speed of the memory. And turns out that the only memory type device that's capable of achieving CPU speed is static RAM. But it's really, really expensive, and if we wanted to build a machine capable of storing a couple of hundred of gigabytes and using static RAM, this machine would cost more than $10 million. So that's unfeasible. So that's why computer manufacturers use some tricks. One is based on this principle called locality that says that at some period of time, the data being accessed is very likely to be accessed in the near future. And this is really a consequence of how we are used to solve problems. That is, we divide problems in sub-problems, and therefore we code by processing data in pieces of data. So while we are processing a piece of data, this piece of data is hot. So computer manufacturers take advantage of this by placing only this hot data in fast static RAM, in this case, close to CPU, and use cheaper and slower devices as a backup for all the other data. And computers have evolved into a hierarchy of these memory levels. Basically, we have CPU, then we have CPU caches based on static RAM, then we have main memory on DRAM, and storage, which is typically disk. And the thing here is that a level below another is typically 1,000 or more times slower. Now, the way these caches are populated have not changed much in the last few decades. Basically, what we do is that we divide all data in blocks of the same size based on location. We sort these blocks according to some metric like frequency or recency, and we cache the most important n blocks in case we have a cache of size n. But, well, these have been working, but things are changing. Now we have new computing paradigms. We have lots of consolidation. We have virtualization. We have storage consolidation. And as an example, the Florida Hospital in Orlando just purchased a couple of ESX halls in order to achieve a consolidation ratio of 11 to 1, which is actually small, could be much higher. And, well, all this consolidation brings a couple of problems for the typical approach that have not changed about caches. The first one is that this leads to duplicated content. We observe with two production web servers here at FIU that when these two web servers are sharing the same buffer cache, that is the same RAM cache, they have a duplication ratio of, 2 to 1, that is almost all blocks are duplicates. Second problem is contention. The first sub-problem with this is that we don't know the effects of, contention has a negative effect of caching, and we are not able to actually measure the effects when we place two or more applications here in the same cache. And the second problem is that this contention creates wasted space, and this wasted space increases linearly with the workload sharing a cache, because of consolidation ratio growing, this is a serious problem. And finally, the third problem, which is a more subtle one, which is that this consolidation ratio increased the requirements of applications from the storage. The performance, the storage performance needs have increased. And well, in order to cope with those demands, main memory has become faster, CPU has become faster, but storage based on this has not become fast enough. So that's why we introduced another level of caching, which is based on SSD on solid state drives, which is much faster than disk. But because also it's expensive, we just use it as a cache typically. And because the storage has to provide some guarantees for consistency, like ordering guarantees to file systems above the storage, and because these solid state drives could fail, people typically implement these caches as write two, that is, writes go directly from SSD to disk. We don't maintain dirty copies of data on SSDs because we want to maintain ordering, and that's why people typically make these caches write two, so we can have the storage on disk consistent.
Why?
Excuse me?
Why?
Why not write back? Because, well, I wanted to show an example later, but basically write back evictions don't provide ordering guarantees.
Yeah, where's the example? Okay. Can you
cash it
for favor? Can you send me this slide?
Yeah, right now.
You want to
see the
slide? Yeah, no.
Okay.
It's all
about, okay.
I have some audience connecting from Europe to Cairo, they're listening to you.
Okay.
You
can send
this back and
forth.
Okay.
So, just
half a minute.
Yeah,
sorry
for
that.
No.
Hey, Ricardo, do you mind? Go ahead, Murali. We are taking do you have the slides, by the way?
Yeah,
I'm looking at slide 19, but could you repeat the question so that I didn't quite hear what the question was?
Yes. It was not, okay, there was a question at some point.
Yeah, the question is why, because Ricardo was saying that a write-through is typically used for SSD caching. So my question is why not write back? What makes that this video? Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
And he said that he has an example, so I'm going to hold on to that. Maybe.
Okay, so, you want me to wait or can I continue? Okay. So, well, the other option instead of write through would be write back, which is just write into the SSD and come back, which will be the best use of the SSD cache, because in this case, we'll actually improve write accesses and not only read accesses in the case of write through. And the problem with this is really a missed opportunity, because we saw that for some realistic benchmarks, we can have an improvement of 5 times better by using write-back compared to write-through. So the problem is really that write-through caches that give these consistent guarantees are just too slow compared to write-back. So that brings me to the thesis statement. We propose improving the state of the art in caching by first eliminating duplication in caches, second modeling applications cache requirements, the effects of contention. Third, solving the cache contention problem by using partitioning. And fourth, achieving consistency guarantees for write-back caches.
So the first one, is it eliminating or reducing?
Let's say reducing. Yeah. 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 I'll change it. Yeah. Yeah. The rest of this talk is divided by all these four problems, but I will only talk about the second, the third, and the fourth. The first one related to the duplication, I'll leave it that for just a document. So I'll start with modeling cache usage and contention. So basically we have many types of applications and servers in the data center, and we would like simple and compact model utilization of applications of cache. So we can compare these against each other and compare these requirements against the resources that servers can provide. And additionally, we would like to be able to aggregate these models and have a an aggregate model which we can also compare against the resources provided by a server. So let's see this with an example. Let's say we have this application. Code is there. This application just walks through an array A and maintains this sum. So in this case, the memory needed for this application is 3 words for the index I, n, which is the size of the array, and sum, and a couple of hundred kilobytes for the executables. So if we plot the miss rate curve, that is the miss rate versus cache size, we will have that for a cache size of size 0, we'll have lots of miss rate. As we increase the size of the cache, we start decreasing the miss rate. And we have these steps. And these steps represent the requirements of the application. For example, the first step is 3 words for I, n, and sum. And the last step is for the executable. And basically, this is what we use to build the model, which is just a tree that we call the effective reuse set size PRSS tree. In this case, this will mean a tree of with root. Actually, this is inverse. Sorry, the root will be 544, and the leaf will be 3 words. So, if we had another example, let's say a more complicated.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yes,
why is still the miss rate? There's still miss rate even if you reach 544 kilobytes. Can you explain why? Should be close to zero.
Yeah, it should be close. This is just a drawing I made. It actually should be zero.
Zero.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's not zero because the first compulsory misses will have some effect, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is not actual data. It's just a drawing I made. Yeah.
When you say the executable, does it include the entire array that you
are referring to? Yes, I was assuming it's also the array. Yeah. So you could have actually another step for the array or something like that. But this is just an example, a simple example. So one use of this tree would be, for example, provisioning or scheduling. If you use it for provisioning, you will see that if we had a tree like this, 5 gigabytes, 144 megabytes, we could easily store the 5 gigabytes in the memory and then the 100 kilobytes on CPU caches on 30 grams. Sorry, 144 megabytes will be in main memory, sorry. So now let's see what happens with aggregation. Let's say we have these two applications, and they have these ERSs at 155 and 251. And let's say we want to aggregate them. So the expected aggregated ERSs, the working set size, will be the sum of these. But it's actually different. When we run these two applications together and measure the effective view set size, we have a larger amount, which is 431 compared to 406. And these extra requirements, this in this case 25 megabytes, we call it a wastage, and can get very large. And now I'll show you with an example what's going on that creates this problem. I'll show you this with a simple example. Let's say we have two applications. We have application one that's just accessing.
How do you calculate the effective reuse distance experimentally?
The effective reuse exercise? Use MRCs like this.
No, I mean experimentally. I understand the MRCs, but let's say, how do you calculate the working set size of the workflow?
Yeah, I have to calculate the MRCs first.
Yeah, how do you
calculate
the MRCs?
Very
briefly.
Yeah, there is an algorithm called Maxon stack algorithm, and basically just that.
So what are the performance counters you measure in hardware level? You measure
somehow? No, this is not hardware level. This is tracing.
Tracing.
I mean, I use the full trace of references to and go in, make it go through this Maxon stack algorithm, and I get the MRC.
Okay.
So I guess, Ricardo, maybe the question can be rephrased. How would you implement a practical system online to estimate the working set?
Yeah. Yeah, for at some levels of the hierarchy, this is easy because you can have all accesses. But for example, CPU cache accesses, it's a bit trickier. We have some work on that and involves tracing memory accesses and then in an offline just going through the references and create the MRC.
So can we rephrase your answer as, in some cases online MRC construction is possible, in other cases we have to profile the application and construct the MRC offline?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
What level of
tests
are you talking about now,
is this
in general?
This is just general. Okay. Right now it's just general.
But are you assuming for selectivity?
Excuse me?
Are you assuming for selectivity?
Yes, yes. Yeah, this is a simple cache. Yeah. Okay, so we have this wastage problem, and I'd like to show you this wastage with a simple example. Let's see, we have two applications. Application one is just accessing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 and like that. And application two is just reusing element A. So let's say we mix these two applications. And let's say they run at the same speed. So we have one access from one, then one access from two, then one access from one, just like this. I can turn in the trace. So now let's see what happens when we use a cache of size two using an LRU stack. And LRU stack works this way. You have an access, you push it into the stack. You have another access A, you push into the stack. So A goes into the top of the stack, one goes below. For two this, another time A this, and like that. So in this case, we have no misses. And that's expected because we had that application one requires one block of cache. Application two requires one block for this reuse of A. So if we give both of them together a cache size of two, we have no misses. That is fine.
No misses for process two.
For process two, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. We have no compulsory misses. That will be more correct. So now let's increase the speed of one. So now we have two accesses from one, then one access from two, then two accesses from one. Like I have the trace below. You can see the cursor, right?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so we increase the speed of one. So now let's give it a cache of size two. We have access one, access two, access A, access three, access four, A misses. So what's going on, right? I mean, we have one block for one, one block for two. We only increase the speed of application one, but we have a miss now. And here we can see the problem. The problem here is that three got more important according to the replacement algorithm than A, even though three is not going to be reused. So now we model this extra space as wastage based on three parameters. Let's model in this case the wastage effect from application one to application two. And this depends on three parameters, which is first the ERSS of application two, the plot rate of application one, and the reuse rate of application two. The plot rate is the rate at which application one is touching elements that is not going to be used. Actually, it's not going to use any of its elements, so the plot rate is actually the speed of application one. Reuse rate of application two is the speed at which it's reusing elements, and in this case, the RSS of two is only one. So let's see the parameters. So ERSS of 2 is 1, float rate of 1 is 2/3, and in this case I'm using a field of size 3.
How do you compute this rate?
Yeah, let's say I'm using a field of size 3. I'm using this because this includes both accesses from both applications. So you have two floats every three accesses, so that's 2/3. And now the reuse rate will be one reuse every three accesses, that's 1/3. And well, if you set this into the equation, you will have a wastage of one.
So in general, flood rate plus reuse rate is one, right?
No.
What do they mean? What do they really mean?
They really mean, I mean, wastage is really, for this example, it should be one, but you could have different, for example, the application flooding could be also reusing. So in that case, it shouldn't be adding to one.
What are the definitions of flooding in this case?
Well, flood rate is just the rate at which the application is flooding. That the application is touching elements that's not going to reuse in a period of time.
Can you give a precise definition of precise what is calculated?
You have a period of time, you count the numbers of floods, and you divide by...
Flood means not reuse.
Flood means not reuse.
Not reuse.
Okay. Yeah.
How do you specify the period of time?
In this simple example, that's simple, but in reality I would use a much larger period. So I might not hit a nice equilibrium of only axis of one and only axis of two. But for a large period, that's an enough approximation.
But you assume it's a repetition.
Yeah. But also there is another thing here which I haven't talked about, which is that applications are usually divided in phases.
Yeah.
And inside a phase, you have pretty much a lot of repetition. Then you change a phase, you have a lot of repetition. This should be done per phase.
Yeah.
I haven't talked about phases to make it simple, but you applications can change. Yeah.
The forest specific window flood rate plus usage rate should be one, right?
No.
For a specific window?
Yeah, no, because let's say in this case, application one is also reusing things. So let's say you have a period of size five, and in these two extra accesses, application one is reusing. So you will have 2/5 and 1/5.
Here it's the flood rate of one application compared to the reuse rate of another application. If you combine all the flood rates and reuse rates for all applications, then you're right. So here, if you look at the subscripts, it's rho f of 1 and rho r of 2.
That I noticed. That's why I was asking for a process for a specific window, you're saying it still need not add to 1. That's because it doesn't use the entire window. According to what Raju said, if you add up all the flood rates...
Oh yeah, if you add up everything, it should be at 1.
In the window, it should be 1.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And one more question. So when you say reuse, you are considering the... What do you mean by reuse? Is that you mean to reuse the next window or in the same window?
In the same window. Okay.
So are all these three measures completely new? I mean, this is something you cooked up?
This is with collaboration with Akshay from IBM, but this is our work. It's only our work.
Oh, but the way to calculate these rates, I mean, these terms...
Yeah, this is our stuff. Yeah.
You mind these terms?
Yeah, we invented these things. Yeah. So this is a web page from 1 to 2. Let's say we have 4 applications. So now we'll have web page of 1 to 2 plus web page of 1 to 3 plus web page of 1 to 4. And if we only have these, it will be linear. But we also have web page of 2 to 1, 2 to 3, 1 to 4. So web page grows a much faster rate than just linear with the number of workers.
Sorry, I'm not forgetting. So what does I to J mean?
This is I to two is the web page that an application one flooding is incurring on application two that's reusing. But you can also have the reverse, which is application two also flooding that's affecting application one. Mm-hmm. So you have flood all combinations. And thing is that this at the end will make a wastage growth linear in proportion to the sum of all the RSS. And we measured this with using some traces we got at FIU at the storage level. And here you can see that as you increase the size of the cache, these three different lines are for different replacement algorithms, which doesn't really matter. The only important thing here to see is that they go linear. And that's a big problem because as you start increasing, you'll hit a point where everything is wasted. And that's bad.
But your previous slide suggests that it cannot be worse than quadratic. Is that something you've seen?
No, I haven't experimentally seen that.
So how do you calculate the wastage?
The wastage, I do it for every possible pair, and I calculate these three parameters, and just plug into the equation.
Oh, okay, explain this equation.
But, oh, you mean how I calculate in this case?
No, the definition.
The definition, okay.
This is also your invention, right?
Yeah, okay. And by the way, this is just for LRU.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, this seems to work for different replacements, but I'm not... Okay, so you have one application one, application two. Application one is flooding, application two is reusing. So you calculate the flood rate of one, the reuse of two, and the RSS of two. That is the kind of the working set of two. And this is the ceiling of ERSS 2 by flood rate of 1. Thing here is that we need ERSS 2 on top because as you increase the working set size of 2, and it's reusing at a specific speed, if you increase the size, it will effectively reuse slower, right? Because it has to touch more things to make them go up into the replacement. And also, flood rate is up because as you increase the flood rate, you have more wastage. But as you increase reuse rate, you have less wastage. So basically, that's the question.
But the question really is, why are you multiplying those two? That's not completely
clear. Why are you multiplying those two? Well, I didn't get this with, a mathematical proof or anything like that. It's just five billion things and these words.
What's the intuition?
The intuition flood rate should go up, right? It should, I mean, wastage is proportional to flood rate. Because as you increase flood rate, you have more wastage. It's also proportional to ERSS of 2, because as you increase the working set size of 2, it has to touch things more. So the speed reduces by the same proportion.
By that same argument, your flood rate for one is appearing both in the numerator and the denominator.
This just made it work. So that's all I can say. Yeah. Let's say it's magic. Yeah. I just tried a lot of combinations and it fit. I'm sorry. That's all I can say. I guess that's the way people prove that gravity is 9 or something. They just try and so it fits.
No, but can you also not explain it by saying something like, okay, you want your race case to be proportional to the fraction of flooding that's happening in any given time, right? The fraction of flooding requires the flooding rate to be at the numerator and the total rate to be at the denominator, which includes the flood and the reuse rate.
Think of it that way, which is
why you have the flooding rate and the denominator as well.
Because the fraction
of time you spend flooding.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right?
Compared to the whole thing.
Yes.
Actually, if you put the whole thing that F1 divided by all those things in a separate bracket, it makes much more sense.
Yeah.
It's easier to explain.
ERSS
multiplied by the whole
fraction.
Move the ERSS out of the
box. ERSS out of the
box,
That makes it very easy.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, it proves gravity for you.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah, sorry for that, I won't make jokes.
Maybe you may want to add the ERSS too. You may want to put a different case study. Of course, you may have a different case study why you came up with this specific number.
Validation.
Yeah, we have some validation on the document. We used a mix of basically what is called VM bench. It's a mix of mail traces, mail application plus some web servers, I think. And we trace the accesses at the CPU cache level because this is for a very simple LRU, so we wanted to see what what's really happening with a more complex cache, like a CPU cache, which has also accessibility and more complex policies. And we wanted to, you know, use these in that scenario. So, yeah, we tried those things.
I think part of the problem here is that this wastage is not pair-wise. The wastage for, let's say, process 2 is a collection of these, right?
Yeah.
And that effect of the collection cannot necessarily be broken down like this. So I'm not totally sold on it. The logic seems okay, but when you write it down, wastage is just a sum of pair-wise wastages. I'm not totally sold on that.
Okay.
Because there are effects of groups that are much more pronounced than just pairwise.
I understand what you mean. That would be kind of a limitation of this. So in summary, for this section, we introduced the ERSS tree model. We saw that contention leads to wasted space, and also that this wasted space grows with the number of workers. So that's why we think it's a serious problem in consolidated environment. So now the next thing would be how to reduce this contention.
Got it. There's a question.
Oh, excuse me, Murali?
Yeah. Hey, can you shed some light on the wasted space thing looks interesting, but can you talk about how much does it directly translate to a performance drop as well, or is that some?
Oh, okay. Let me show you that with an example. Go to slide.
There's no slide number.
Okay.
The one after.
Go to slide 30, please.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, let's say this is the MRC for two applications running together. Okay?
Yeah.
So let's say you calculated the aggregated second ERSS at the level of 544. You calculated it as 500, let's say, 500 kilobytes. And then you give these two applications 500 kilobytes and run it, and you actually see that at 500 kilobytes you are above the mean. Right? You have this really large gap in mean.
Okay.
So this will be a bad case scenario, what would happen. You are just in the limit of you're very close to this mean. If you give it just a little bit less cache size than that the actual space it needs, you start missing by a huge amount.
Okay.
So these things can happen. So we actually have some numbers for this and on the next section of actual performance in terms of execution times and reboot times and things like that. So that will show you a specific number, but in the meanwhile, this is what can happen.
I see. Okay.
Okay, so now let's go back to the problem slide where I have reduced contention in number 3. So
also, can I have a follow-up question there?
Sure, go ahead.
So it also seems like there's some periodicity that error usually it takes advantage of. And if that period changes, like you said, it's slowing down or faster, that's what messing things up more than just the, you know, the MRCs. The MRC just shows a static understanding of why it's falling off.
Yeah.
But it seems that if the periods are different, then all sorts of bad things can happen.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Well, the MRC just shows that. That's true.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So again, we saw the discontention thing is bad, so we would like to actually reduce it. So let's see the same example again. We have application 1 and application 2. Application 1 is flooding, affecting application 2. So ideally what we would do is to, you know, isolate the flooding of 1. And the simple way of doing this would be to actually partition the cache. So now the cache of size 2 is just two caches of size 1. And now you can give a cache of size 1 to 1, a cache of size 1 to 2, and then they will run separately and they won't affect each other and they will just run fine. The obvious question is how much cache space to give to each other. This is just a figure that shows that now you have a different, you know, I talked at the beginning in the introduction that typically you just have one ordering for all the blocks. Now you have one per partition. Right? You use recency or frequency or whatever in each partition, and you cache the top n for each of the partitions. And the basic question is how much cache space to give to each partition. And let's see this problem graphically. So this is the partitioning problem. Let's say you have two guests. And let's say we're plotting the miss rate versus cache size for both of these two applications. So I'll show you just, it's just a visual, I'll just move things around so you can see this problem visually more clearly. So let's flip the miss rate curve of guest 2. And now let's put one on top of the other. So cache size of application 1, of guest 1, is matching the total S cache size of application 2. And cache size S of application 1 is matching cache size 0 of application 2. So if you put them together overlapping, you will have this. So now, in this case, if you plot the sum of the both curves, you will have the function that you actually want to minimize, which is the sum of miss rates at different possible partitions. For example, here in the middle, you will have the sum of miss rates if you give application 1 half of the cache and if you give application 2 half of the cache. And this actually matches the sweet spot, the minimum of this function, the minimum sum of miss rates that you can achieve. This is a simple case because in this case we have only one value, so you could use a simple approach like a Hill descent approach, very simple. But it's actually a much more complex problem. And Rajkumar proved that it's actually NP-hard, and that's why many approximation algorithms for this problem have been proposed, and most of them...
NP-hard for minimizing...
For minimizing the sum of miss rates. this is a specific problem. Yeah. Things that many approaches have been based on the convex hull approach, which I'm going to talk about next. And basically what they do here is that, as you can see, you can have cases where you don't have a single value. You can have these things. So if you apply a local search, like greedy approach, you can stuck in a local minima, you will miss the global minimum sum of miss rates. So this convex hull approach, what it does is that it calculates the convex minimum of the sum. It will be like smoothing out the curve into this black curve. So now you have a nice smooth and convex function, so you just use a simple greedy approach. And these have been applied to CPU caches and RAM caches and has been working fine with good results by many researchers. But when we try to apply it to for example, at SSD caches, we had some problems. And the problem is that SSD storage caches can serve different types of requests. Specifically, you can serve requests that are larger than the block size. So let me show you this in an example. Let's say you have an application randomly accessing 1 million blocks. Here you have 1 million blocks. So... As you can count them. So let's say this application is accessing these blocks at the granularity of the cache block size. So if you plotted the miss rate curve, you will have a linear decrease of miss rate versus cache size, which is expected. You have miss rate of 1 with cache 0 and a miss rate of almost 0 when you have all the blocks in the cache. But now, let's see what happens if you increase the size of the request. So now, let's say you're accessing, your request requires 3 blocks at a time. So the chances of hitting actually decrease, because now you don't only need one compared to the previous case, but you need actually the 3 of them to be in cache. If you miss only one of them, you have to wait for everybody, so that's considered a miss. So the effect of that is that this shifts the curve into a concave curve. And for example, if you had half of the cache, the thing here is that let's say you have a cache of 1 megabyte and you have requests of 1 kilobyte, you have half of the cached. Half of the working set cache. You have a half chance that you will hit it. But let's say you increase the size of the request, let's say to close to 1 megabyte. Even if you have half of the cache, you don't have half the chances of hitting, because you have to hit the whole thing. And this gets the curve concave. And the problem with this is that for the convex tool approach, both these curves have the same convex mineral. So both these curves will be treated the same way by the algorithm. And this actually contradicts the observation made by previous researchers that most MRCs are convex. So making this approximation don't change things much.
So why can't they admission systems where all request sizes are the same size and eliminate this problem altogether?
The thing is that storage systems are built in such a special way where having request size which are larger improve performance.
Which layer of cache you're talking about now?
Excuse me?
Which layer?
The SSD cache.
And aren't most of the I/O structure aligned?
It couldn't be, but let's say it is. It won't change anything.
So that looks like you are talking about the block level, processing level.
I'm referring to the block size of the cache.
Block size of the cache.
Yeah, which could be anything. No, but in this, let's say it's 4K.
Yeah, but at block level, the most requests you receive are 4K, right?
That's for writes, right? And you could have reads much larger. And you actually observe that. Excuse me?
When I was doing down through the page cache, most of the IOs you see will be 4K aligned.
Yeah.
You won't see an 8K, you won't see a 4K.
Okay, so let's say this is a more generic approach. This was actually implemented as at the hypervisor level.
Okay.
And then the optimal block size is much larger. It's in the order of megabytes. Okay. So let's say you move one level below on the software stack and you have larger caches, larger block size, larger
hypervisor level. So where are the IOs from?
Excuse me?
You're implementing the cache in hypervisor level.
Oh, yeah, that's
correct. Who's issuing the IOs?
Well, the guests are issuing the IOs, but the hypervisor can do whatever he wants with the IOs, like merging, prefetching, right? But the IOs I'm getting are the IOs after these, manipulated by the hypervisor.
Okay. Can I steer the conversation a little bit? So, are IO sizes at the storage level fixed size?
No, they don't have.
Okay. So that's the basic observation that you have to point out, that IO sizes could be arbitrary size, whereas caches are still managed at some small granularity, some fixed granularity, which is what causes this problem.
But those granularities, the IOs that you receive, they are mostly fixed size.
There are multiples of fixed size, but there could be any size. Multiples of 4 kilobytes typically.
Yes.
But there could be a
small unit would be 4K. So that's why I don't get it. So if I make a cache unit always 4K, then yes, like I said, I may receive, say, 4 or 4K. Okay.
And the thing is that when you're servicing that I request, all of each of those 4Ks need to hit in the cache. Otherwise, it's a miss. Right, if it's a large request. So large requests are inherently different than small requests.
Why that make it, if I receive 4 4Ks, if I treat that as 4 4Ks instead of 1 6 4K?
Oh, okay, I understand your question.
Then I will have a half feed.
Yeah, the thing is that, let's say you wanted to translate mid-rate into latency seen by the application, right? The latency seen by the application actually depends on the latency of the request, right? Not on the latency of each piece of the request. So if you have if the application is making very, very large requests, it will have a higher latency than if the application makes very small requests, right?
Now I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay. So we implemented this partitioning at the for an SSD cache at the hypervisor level for the SI hypervisor, and we implemented this, you know, this thing where we use full MRCs. We don't smooth them into convex holes, and we use a probability search. We use in this case simulated annealing. And so
Ricardo, here in this environment, each ESX machine has a SSD associated to it.
No, this is a single host.
Single host,
and you have one partition per VM. VM1 has its partition, VM2 has its partition. So we implemented this, and the first experiment we tried was to measure reboot time. It's not boot, it's reboot. That means the cache is already warmed up by the first boot. We did this with 28 virtual desktops. We reboot them simultaneously. First with no cache. Reboot time was 55 seconds. Then with a unified, that is the traditional global unified cache approach. And reboot time, the average boot reboot time was 39 seconds. And then we used this partitioned approach, and reboot time was reduced to 32 seconds. This, in proportion, would be 32% of the 55 compared to 29% for the unified approach of the 55 seconds in the vanilla case with no cache.
So when I did this experiment, did you start with the cold cache?
But this is reboot, right?
So it was, the cache was cold now already?
Because of the boot, the first boot, yeah.
How long does it take to compute the position?
Simulated annealing is a tunable algorithm, so you can trade off execution time versus the quality of the results you get. So in the worst case, you could tune it to try every single combination. But in our case, we used I don't remember the name, but some guy proposed some generic metrics for tuning simulated annealing. I used those, and it wasn't using more than, let's say, 1 second. It was unnoticeable compared to actually, you know, partitioning, making the ISU partition and things like that. Yeah. The second experiment was replaying, this is not only, this is actually, I think, 4 hours of some FIU traces we got at the CL department, which are the mail server, some home directory traces we got from our local lab machines, and 2 web servers from the department. We replayed these traces using first unified cache of 1 gigabyte, and we observe 0.9 million misses for these 4 hours. Then we use the partition cache approach, and we observe 0.7. So in this case, we have a difference of 0.2 million misses, and this would translate to 1 gigabyte of wasted transfer just for using this unified cache. And this, at the end, will affect overall performance, just this transfer.
Ricardo, one question. So do you have to repartition the cache in some interval, or
oh, yeah. We do this every interval. It comes
so
with...
How long is the interval?
In this case, it's every 3 minutes, I think. Yeah. Well, this is Like an open question,
okay,
right now.
Yeah,
you just used a hard coded value of a few 5 minutes. But this should, in ideally, this should depend on the phases of the application, right? Because if the application is stable, it's in this very large stable phase, you shouldn't make changes. It's just nice and quiet and stable. You should somehow adapt to the changes and make the partition, but we don't have anything on that.
So you calculate the MRC online or offline?
And this is online. In this case, we can do it online because you, at the storage level, you can actually see the request. Right?
So you compute the MRC based on the request that was sent in the past?
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
And well, this guest partitioning algorithm, you're using the variation of
simulated anonymity? Well, simulated anonymity is a generic local search, so I'm just using it.
Okay. How often do you do that?
Every 5 minutes.
Did you compare with the convex
approach? Yeah, I don't have numbers right now, but yes, I made some comparisons, and for this second case, there were some significant differences. I don't remember the number, but for other ones, we had to push it a little bit, you know, to make requests large enough so you can start having problems with the convex approach. But I think still valid because you can have any arbitrary size. Right?
What is the overhead for partitioning itself?
The overhead for partitioning is...
That's computing the MRC.
Well, it's computing the MRC and also is moving things around from one partition. For example, reducing a partition size, it's actually evicting stuff. If you have write-byte cache, you have to evict things, dirty things. That's cost. And when you increase the size of the cache, in our case, we're just increasing the maximum size, but you're not actually populating the extra space. We're just increasing the size. I consider that approach. Yeah. But it was better for at least these experiments to just leave the new space there so you can use it.
If you do MRC online, then
excuse me, I couldn't hear. Can you?
You said you take this MRC online. You assume that you have extra resources to perform.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about this research, you mean actual CPU cycles to perform the algorithm and to memory to, yeah, it's very small. It's really, really small.
Hey, Ricardo?
Excuse me?
Hey, I have a question. On slide 90, you mentioned the trace replay produced a certain number of misses. But going back to some of your earlier slides, it looks like your definition of a miss is that even if, you know, a portion of the request, IO request, hits in the cache, that is treated as one miss. Is that correct?
Yeah, in this case, it will be request missing. That's the count.
Okay, but the only concern I have is that, you know, the number of misses therefore doesn't necessarily translate to actual latency gains or performance gains, right? Because, you know, let's say, you know, most of the like misses are for a sector or a couple of, you know, really small blocks that aren't in the cache, then your latency is not that high. And so, in other words, what I'm saying is that 0.9 million misses in the unified cache case doesn't tell me what it will translate to or whether it is worse than the 0.7 million misses in the partition case.
That's definitely true. What he's saying is that not all misses have the same cost. So
these
don't mean much. But things that on the, we also treated that problem, which is minimizing the sum of latencies. And what we do is, after computing the MRC, we use some observer metrics we got, like latency of read, latency of write, subsequential is the workload, and then compute a latency versus cache size for all the guests. And then you can have a more realistic performance maximization. But I didn't show that in this presentation, but most of the experiments we did that are on the TC document are related to actually minimizing the sum of latency. But I didn't want to talk about that because that's an extra level of complexity.
Okay. Yeah, I think we should talk about that over email or something. I'm curious to know how that thing turns up or what insights you have on the latency minimization
okay.
thing.
Okay, that would be nice. Okay. So in summary for this section, partitioning can be used for different websites. We saw that this convex hull approach, which has been applied to CPU and buffer caching, do not work for out-of-order caches. And we also showed an actual implementation and some realistic experiments that show that when using a probabilistic search, we can have a substantial reduction in misses. And also in the test, we show that reduction in latencies and improvement in the throughput. Okay. So now let's go to the final problem, which is trying to adding guarantees for consistency, in this case, ordering guarantees into write-back. So first, why is this an important problem? The thing is that by having write-through caches, we are only optimizing read access. And workloads can be write-intensive. For example, we observed in our FIU traces that 70% of the accesses were write. So it makes sense to actually think more about these file accesses and optimize them, so they not just leave the caches as write through.
So regarding one question, are those writes random writes or sequential writes?
I don't know, but that's a good point because sequential writes won't have a very large negative effect.
Exactly.
Yeah,
because I'm assuming those are journal writes or
Yes, but still, even if you had a really huge array with very nice performance.
No, I mean, it's okay. I just wanted to know.
Oh, yeah, no. The thing is that you can, with a big array, what I wanted to say is that you can hit points where with any array you can have better latencies for writes with a local SSD. Even if you had a huge array with a huge cache and many disks. Excuse me, Murali?
So just a quick comment here. I think the answer here is that most writes are random in nature, especially if you consider an ESX deployment in a clustered environment. The disk is actually shared across multiple initiators and multiple hosts. And so at least on the storage side, all the accesses that you get, it's pretty much a jumbled mix from across all these hosts. So it is random.
But even at that level, ESX could sequentialize writes, right?
At least on ESX, we don't do any optimization with respect to allocation policies and layout because the array that sits, the disk that sits between us is not a traditional spinning disk, right? It's really a SCSI LUN abstraction provided by an enterprise class disk array. So in other words, a LUN does not necessarily equate to one spinning disk. So all these allocation policies are premature, and we don't do that. Therefore.
Okay.
But your high level point is that having an SSD it will help in any scenario. So that's still true.
Okay, that's good. Okay, thank you.
Where are these
traces
coming from?
Specifically, the machine called Kira, the mail server, for homes from our lab, web research and online. which are web servers, the web for the Moodle.
Moodle.
Is this correct?
Is this correct? Is this correct? Is
this correct? Yes.
So, I have one question that's probably mostly ignorant of solid state. Like, so, I thought you said somewhere in your dissertation that it's not really in the IO path. But the way you've shown it, it seems like it is, so I'm a little bit confused.
What did I say exactly? It should be in the IO path. Mm-hmm.
You said several times
that it's
not. I'll find it.
So it's not in the IO path in the same way that memory and CPU are.
So yeah, that's what I understood.
Because SSD needs to be explicitly accessed, right? It's not accessed automatically.
Does every IO access go through that or not?
Okay. No. You can actually go directly to disk and not go into SSD.
Yeah, but this picture is...
That's a good thing. Yeah, you don't have... You can make it go through, but you don't have it. Yeah.
It's just that when you use your hypervisor or whatever, then it does simulate this architecture. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, what I was trying to say is just that there should be a cache for this, and that's why I put it above. But you should have a line going like this, right? But it wouldn't make the problem that nice. Yeah. So that's a trade-off. So let's compare write through with write back. So let's have one safe type of write through, which is writing to the... I'll be referring to the disk that is the backend storage of the SAN, the storage array network. So the safest approach will be to write to SAN first, wait for the completion of that, then write to the SSD, wait on the completion of that, and then notify the guest that the write complete. The write back approach will be just writing to the SSD and come back. If we just compare these two, given the fact that SAN, the disk is much shorter than the SSD, write back should be definitely faster than write through. But write back has an extra thingy, you know, which is eviction. The thing is that write back maintains dirty blocks on SSD. So with a write back cache, anytime you want to allocate space in the cache, you have to evict, that is, copy the dirty stuff from the SSD cache to the disk. And that's also costly. So at the end, what we are doing here is just delaying this IO to the, you know, to the disk. And so the thing here is that whether write through or write back performance is better, it's not that straightforward. But that's why we run a couple of benchmarks to actually measure this. And this experiment is TPCC, which is an online transaction processing workload. In this case, it simulates, I think, an online store. And we used an SSD cache of size 10 gigabytes, and we compare write through with write back. And what we observed is that for all type of transactions, even the ones that are not that much write intensive, we have a better response time for write back. And actually, we saw 5 times better performance for write back. But performance is not the only dimension we are interested in when comparing cache's approach and write policies. We have performance. We saw that write back is better, more in these cases at least. We also have staleness. Staleness is just a measure of how back in time is the data. In this case of a write back, you see that because the caches maintain new dirty data, you can have all copies of the data on disk. So that's stale data. That's staleness. And we also have consistency. By being write through, the write through policies, write through caches provide consistency because they provide full ordering guarantees. But write back don't. So
what's the difference in consistency and staleness?
Let's say you have an old version of a file system which is consistent, but because it's old, it's stale. It has stale.
What's the definition of consistency?
Okay. Right now, I'll use it vaguely, but in the next slides, I'll try to define it more precisely in file system, in the file system context. So just for now, we have write back and write through in these three dimensions. We have write back, which provides high performance, bad staleness, and no consistency. And write through, which provides bad performance, high consistency, and no staleness. So I plotted this basically to show that there are many different points where you might need your cache to be, but you only have two choices. We want more choices. We might want to be able to, for example, trade off performance and staleness. But for now, let me talk about the consistency issue and why. First, what is consistency? And second, why write back has consistency issues for a cache? So let's narrow this consistency thing into file system consistency. So let's say you have a journal and file system. So journal and file systems achieve consistency by, in some sense, making file system operations atomic. For example, let's say you have the deletion of a file. The deletion of a file involves two steps. One is deleted the blocks of the file from the bitmap of used blocks, and also removing this file from the list of files of the file directory. If you have any one of these operations and not the other, you can have the file system in an inconsistent state. For example, if you didn't remove the bit from the bitmap, but you have it pointing from the parent directory, you can have garbage in your file because so that somebody else would be writing thinking that it's free. Journal and file system achieve atomicity of both these two operations by using transactions. Basically, what they do is that they somehow make the updates. The two updates, and only when both updates are ready, they write a block saying that these updates are finished, that the transaction is committed. Okay, so here is very important because here there is this idea of ordering. You have to definitely have the commit transaction after these two. Ready. The problem would appear if, for example, you change the ordering and you have the commit transaction before the removing from the parent directory and you crash. So there you will have a problem because you will have one of operations and not the other. The problem with the write-back caches is that evictions don't guarantee that the ordering is the same as the ordering of the writes. So you can evict out of order and crash in the middle and leave the storage below the disk, the file system on the disk, inconsistent. That's a problem. So
if I switch this two and the single entity. So I can see both SSD and the airline storage and a single disk.
Yeah.
And I still have consistency in this single disk.
Oh, you have consistency at single disk, but what if we wanted to provide extra levels of consistency? For example, being able to survive a crash in only the SSD, but not on disk.
So what do you mean by surviving a crash on the SSD?
Let's say your SSD stops working. That shouldn't mean that all the data you have on disk is inconsistent and not usable anymore, right?
Yeah.
So we try to implement this ordering, guaranteeing this ordering of the evictions. We first tried the basic approach, which would be just storing the ordering of the completions of all the IOs we see, all the writes we see to the SSD. Let's say you had both these A, B, and C requests. We log the completion times, and then we evict in the same order. But this has a problem. That is that if we did this, and let's say you have two applications and we have accesses in parallel. If we have a single linear ordering metric, we would lose the idea that A and X can be executed at the same time. We will lose parallelism. And for most devices, especially big arrays like last time, parallelism is a big win. You can increase performance. So that's why we implemented this we store this disordering using a different structure. In this case, we use a tree. The idea is that if we have, for example, two pointing to three, so the arrows are missing. If we have two pointing to three, that means that two, we observe that two was issued after the completion of three. And by having a tree like this, you can have situations where you can evict all of these independent rights in parallel and then gain some performance. So at the end, what you would do is that, let's say your eviction algorithm tells you that you want to evict block 4. So to be consistent, you will have to evict everything before block 4. And because now we have this idea that all of these are independent, you can evict all of these together, and all of these together, and all of these, well, which is something like that, yeah. But this also brings a second problem, which is that because we're trying to maintain the full ordering, we need to also write all the intermediate copies of the same block. In this case, we have writes to block 1, write to block 2, and also write to block 2, but we need to save all copies because it could crash here in the middle. And these extra copies is a problem that the original write-back cache didn't have. So this is introducing some performance overhead. In this case, we...
So this is, what are the numbers mean?
Okay. A line from two, you see the cursor, right?
Yes.
A line from two to three means that we observe that three was completed, and after completed, two was issued. So you could see that as a dependency. You could see that as, okay, if two was issued after the completion of three, it could mean that two depends on three. So you cannot send this at the same time. But if, for example, you observe that all these blocks were issued at the same time and they didn't wait for the completion of each other, you could assume that these are independent.
By the way, those numbers should not be all...
Oh, yeah. Let's say this is 4 and 5. No, 6. But the problem here is that you need to store all writes.
What's the line? You have two here?
That's why you need to write... You need to store all writes. Let's say the history of accesses is just writes to block 1, block 2, block 1, block 2, block 1, block 2. You cannot just write the last 1 and 2 because they can get mixed. So that's why we write everything, all the 1s, all the 2s, all the 1s, all the 2s. So we need all copies of 1 and all the all copies of 2. So that brings a huge problem because this is kind of wasting space that the original write-back approach wasn't.
Now that you only need to save the ordering, why do you need to store several copies of the same block?
Because you want to perform exactly the same writes as you saw to the SSD. Mm. But to perform the exact same writes, you need the data as well, right?
Okay.
And to see the effects of these extra space for copies, we run Postmark. In this case, using write to, write back, and this version of write back, which we call write back order. And what we observe is that as you increase the size of the cache, you have a gap in performance. In this case, performance is measured as the read hit ratio. That is the read hit ratio. The thing is that by introducing these extra cache spaces being used by these copies, you decrease the chances of hitting into the cache, and that will affect performance. And that's bad. So we need something else. That's why we came up with this other approach, which we call journal write-back. And basically what we do is that, let's say we start with a consistent view of the storage, with a consistent state of the disk. So now, let's say we have to evict block E. So in the previous approach, what you will have to do is to evict everything before this state consistent and E in order. But what if we could just evict all the the newer copies of these as a single atomic transaction. That is, whether you go to the next consistent step or you don't.
So Ricardo, how do you think when you're in a consistent state?
Well, we don't have to detect whether you're in a consistent state or not, right? And let's say you boot or for the first time you are consistent, and this will guarantee that you move or not to a consistent state.
Yeah, but how do you guarantee that that point there is consistent and not the point before, let's say, right to, before the right before?
We are using a transaction, right?
Every point is consistent, and you can stop or create your transaction at any point in time.
If you, let's say you crash here.
No, that's not my point. My point is that how do you know that you're moving from one consistent state to another consistent state?
If you ensure that this eviction of all of these are atomic, you have to.
Yeah, but what I mean is that your transaction could be the, you had previous, on a previous slide, you had that a transaction was three things, right? Three steps.
Yeah.
Read something, then read something else, and then write a commit or
yeah.
Right? So let's say that you say, okay, the consistent state is the first after the first two, and since you don't know the semantics, I'm assuming you don't know, you didn't know that you had to include the additional write in your consistent state.
Oh, okay, I see your point. If you crash here.
What I'm saying is that
if you crash anywhere here and you're still maintaining ordering, if you crash here before the committing, you're still consistent. The only thing you need
okay.
to provide is order.
No, but what if I would assume that my consistent state would be to write up to the blue spot?
Well,
and
that's all that journal default system will provide you, right? The journal default system could also crash here. And not having this, but having this, but this will be at the middle of the transaction. The transaction is not committed, with the commit transaction is the actual atomic.
Okay, so I'll take it offline because,
Ricardo, if I may step in, I think the question is you're implementing this at the hypervisor, right? I think perhaps the question is that there is a consistency from a file system point of view, but there is also an app level consistency. This method that you've outlined will help you get basic file system level consistency by just adhering to the right ordering. But it will not get you app level consistency, and that requires app level, suppose you're running a database.
Yeah.
For the database itself to be quiet, you need to quiet the database for you to get a consistent image. And I think that's what the person who asked the question.
Oh, yeah, this is just consistency.
So, in any way, that doesn't come for free. I guess the answer is that you have to integrate, these points of consistency with your application. Like Windows, for example, has a framework for applications to register their quiescing handlers and things like that. So, anyway, it's a long story. I think we have to take that offline.
Okay. So, what you're saying is that the application should know about these transactions and committing and all that.
A well-written app has hooks for, or rather will register for hooks to get into these quiet paths and all that.
Okay. So let's say we are able to perform these all the evictions of all of these guys atomically. So by having that, you could move from one consistent state to the other, or in case you fail, you stay in the all consistent state. We implement this journal, one way would be at the storage side. You ask the storage to start a transaction and you ask the storage to move, to commit the transaction atomically, so you will move from this consistent to the other consistent state. Well, we implemented all these approaches and we used FOSMAC to compare the performance. In this case, the metric is transactions per second for Postmark, and we try different cache sizes. And what you see here is that what we expected is that up is better performance, so write back will have the best performance for every cache size. The worst will be write true, but in some cases you have worse performance for write back order because of the problem I mentioned with storing copies. And we have the order, the journal right back in the middle, which is kind of what we expected. We expected to have write policy that gets us between right through and right back. And actually, we can.
So what's that strategy? Like, to do now, how is that?
Excuse me?
To do the power of the now?
2 gigabytes.
2 gigabytes?
Yeah, 2 gigabytes. This is in bytes. Yeah. So again, we have the 3 dimensions. So we observe, we see that performance for unit write back is a bit better than outerate, but not as good as write back. Both of these options have staleness, but they also provide at least basic buffer system consistency. And moreover, we tried a way of trading off performance with staleness, and we tried this with the journal write back write policy. And basically what we did is to limit the maximum number of uncommitted dirty pages, that is limiting the size of the transactions of the journal. And this will be a measure of staleness. And what we have here is a plot of transactions per second for Postman versus this log for staleness. And here you can see that we were able to, well, to move from right through, which is the dotted line on the bottom, to right back, which is the dotted line on top. Basically, what we're doing here is that by adjusting this staleness value, we are able to be right through or right back. And that makes sense, because if you have zero staleness, you are right through. If you have full staleness, unlimited staleness, you are right back. And this is good, because now we can have middle points in these 3 dimensions, at least in performance and staleness.
So this picture shows all 3, right through, ordered right back, and general right back, just having roughly the same level of consistency. Is that correct?
If it's just policies and consistency, they have the same level of consistency. It's just that all the right back versions have staleness. They can have all copies of the file system, but it's consistent.
Except the plain write back.
Except the plain write back, yes.
No, so the plain write back is kind of bogus, right? I mean, without basic write through, without consistency, nobody actually deploys write back in this fashion. I think that point on that hypercube should move to, you know, just above journal write back. And the basic version of write back, if it doesn't have consistency, it's bogus. Nobody uses that.
So I have a question for you. So we try to look for some versions of write back which provide some other some level of consistency guarantees, and we couldn't find any. Do you have some pointers to that?
What kind of pointer? Sorry, I didn't quite understand.
But you were saying that people don't use basic write-back approaches. They use some modified write-backs that provide something more, right? I understand that as...
In other words, I think you can think of the scheme that you outlined, right? The write-back scheme where we replay the transactions, replay the writes in the order in which they were completed. I think that's a basic requirement for write-back's correctness. Staleness is one thing, but consistency is, you know, we cannot compromise on that. Applications will break left, right, and center.
Okay.
And so, one way to think about this problem is write back is equivalent to long distance replication. So, you know, you think of your scenario where you have a primary site and a disaster site, your writes are written only to the local site, and they're asynchronously replicated to the back, to the disaster site. All these asynchronous replication algorithms have the same, you know, failure and ordering guarantees that a write-back system promises. So in other words, without write ordering guarantees, neither write-back is useful nor is async replication useful.
Actually, that brings a good point. The only related work for these new write-back versions I have is basically related to remote sync, what you're saying, right? I couldn't find any reference to any cache implementation using
The reason for that is also clear, right? I think the reason in a virtualized environment is because if your write-back cache is on a local flash device, you are subject to multiple availability problems, right? Hosts going away and the SSDs going away.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is one of the... And virtualization depends on, at least on ESX, depends on the data being in a shared location, right? Like things like vMotion won't work, all sorts of, you know, problems have to be solved. So it's not because the problem is not important, it's just nobody has done it this so far.
Okay.
But in other words, what I'm saying is, all I'm saying is that the write back that you put where its consistency is zero, I think that is bogus. It needs to be moved to the other end of the queue.
Oh, okay. Okay. So in that sense, there's no work left for me, right? You have write back, which is high performance, consistent, so that should be enough for the work.
I don't think that's what Murali is trying to say.
Yeah, exactly. What I'm saying is, it still suffers from staleness, and you know that part is a given, right? I think you, your other 2 points in the spectrum, I try to address that, right?
Oh, yeah.
So Murali, if I rephrase what you just said, that point, the write back point in that case,
yeah,
it's not a used point. It's not something that people use. Is that
yes?
Okay.
That's correct.
That's what he's saying.
Okay.
Actually, there are two other interesting things that I wanted to bring up here. One is the usability of write ordering. It's a little bit more nuanced than what you've outlined, Ricardo. So typically, applications are deployed in multi-tiers where each application is in a separate virtual machine. And so your write ordering is actually, it translates to also what is called as a consistency group. So the groups of communicating applications, you also have to adhere to the write ordering across these applications. And that is a very, very challenging problem because it's now not enough for you to look at the order in which writes completed on one host, but you have to look at the order in which these groups of communicating applications completed their writes across several hosts. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I use the assumption that typically virtual disks on ESX are never shared.
Oh, no, disks aren't shared. I'm not saying that. So, but the point is, in a multi-tier app, the disks aren't shared, but the apps could communicate with themselves. So, for example,
I understand what you mean. Okay, yeah.
So the consistency group thing, especially across different virtual machines, that imposes an additional level of write ordering that your scheme is not, you know, perhaps it's not important, it's not relevant. But that's an important point to consider. The other important point is storage level snapshots. So when you're doing all these things, right, so in slide 112, you talk about this, you know, this being consistent, that being consistent.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that will not work if storage on the back end decides to take a snapshot at any point in between. So, for example, long distance, you know, replication for disaster recovery and all that, the way it works is the storage software, you know, decides to wake up at some point, take a snapshot of the LUN, and then, you know, send that over to the WAN on the other side. And this is used in, you know, when, for example, if the primary site goes down and all that. That has a problem as well, because now, if you're doing all these optimizations, saying, oh, I'm consistent here, and then the next point I'm going to be consistent is there, that assumption breaks down if the storage decides to take snapshots at inconsistent points of time.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I haven't thought about that.
I think those are very good points for future work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So in that graph.
These are.
Yes.
Okay.
That graph, so you said that when you increase the staleness, you have the same performance and write-back. Right?
Yeah.
And you're saying that then it means that what you are doing here is more that actually what you're doing here, I think, is better. Because even though you're increasing the staleness for a mosh and you have the write-back performance, the same as the write-back performance, you still guarantee the ordering of the writes. So basically, even though the file system all you need is very old, right, it's still consistent, something that is not guaranteed by the write-back at all.
Yeah, that's true. Is WG save on top of the other write-back?
No. This write through. You can implement write through in many different ways. I'm just calling this one write through save.
How do you combine that with the outer write?
I don't.
You don't. Okay.
Yeah. This is just something I compare against. So in this case. In this case, I forgot to say that. In this case, I'm fixing the size of the cache, and I'm plotting, for example, for write through state, I think I used 2.1 gigs. At that level, I have 30 something of transactions per second. That's the 30 something I have here.
Two questions. So what's the overhead of all the write?
The overhead of all the write back is basically having these extra copies.
Maintaining
these extra copies, and that is reducing heat pressure because that's using extra cache space. That's the main overhead.
Also, you're writing additional blocks to disk, writing all versions of data.
Yeah, but let me explain this with another experiment I did. I performed an experiment where I do exactly the same things as I would do in write-through. It's in write-back, but I have the exact same address, but I'm storing the copies. When I perform that variant, I have the exact same performance as the full write-back order. So that means that the main performance overhead, actually the only performance overhead, is because of the copies. Right?
So you have a performance data. This is only the heat ratio. You have performance data.
Yes, I have.
You did this?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much overhead?
What I'm saying is that it will be exactly the same as here.
So actually, Ricardo, I didn't want to spoil the fun for you, but actually it turns out that even for write through, you have to do no non-overwrites. I'll either let you think about it for a day or two and tell me why, or I can tell you the reason.
I don't know why, but I'll think about it.
Yeah, we can talk offline. I mean, think about a race condition where there are two writes in flight. To overlapping portions of an offset, and what happens with and without a cache. We can talk about it over email. But in other words, it's not true that write through you can get away with not having the overwrite. Having the non-overwrite policy. Yeah.
Okay.
So one other thing I had a question on the results on page on slide 113 is that. It tells me that the write back journal thing achieves higher transactions per second, but from your thing, first of all, there is no way to do an atomic transaction without consuming additional space, right? On the SAN as well as on the flash. I think that part, like compared to write back ordered, where you're only consuming extra space on the SSD, the write back journal has to consume additional space on the SAN as well as on the SSD. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yes.
And still it achieves higher performance?
Even if it uses extra space on SAN, that won't mean necessarily worse performance, right?
Okay, let me rephrase my question. I guess what I meant is that you have to do two additional IOs, one to the SAN journal and then another IO from the SAN journal to the actual file locations.
I didn't say this, but in this case, that is not exactly what was implemented. In this case, the journal is on the SSD. And it's a very basic journal. The committing of the journal is not actually copying things from the journal to the final position. It's just writing the mapping, just writing the mapping for the blocks you are writing, and just saying this is ready, this is committed.
What's the Windows address here?
The transaction size is I think 4,000 in this case. Yeah, in one entry.
So you're assuming that after a crash, the host comes back and consults the journal and replaces things again before allowing the SAN to be accessed.
Yeah. So that's why on the thesis on the actual document, we have two different types of write-back journal. One is only host side, and the other is host side and server side and storage side. And the one I implemented is just the host side, which also provides fewer consistency guarantees. For example, one is that you require to reread the journal from the SSD the next time you boot, but you might not actually can. You couldn't in some cases.
Right, so sure. Here, I actually am curious about what Murli thought about some of the assumptions that we are making, right, or you are making, which is that hypervisor VM crash probability is greater than hypervisor crash probability, which is greater than SSD failure probability. Right? So this is sort of the assumptions that we are baking into this work, right?
So, okay.
So I don't know if what you think about that assumption, and I would like to hear your thoughts.
No, so from an academic point of view, I think that those are reasonable assumptions to make. But if you look at the reality, though, host crashes are, quite common. I mean, operator errors, like in a system with thousands of machine power failures and machine crashes are pretty common. So having a journal on the flash is not an acceptable thing from a, in a production environment. That is clearly out of the question. It needs to at least be replicated to a bunch of SSDs on different hosts, or like what Ricardo pointed out, the journal has to be on the SAN. But more importantly, though, the invariant that you have to guarantee here is that the storage cannot be accessed until the journal is replayed, which is very difficult to do in a clustered environment, because the storage is actually shared by several hosts. And so, if this host crashes, its journal has to be replayed by somebody else. Applications are there.
So these are all good pointers to note down as part of future work. We just got a whole bunch of future work pointers.
Yeah.
Which are very important. If the work cannot be used in practice, then half its charm is gone. Right.
Yeah.
One more comment for evaluation as well. I feel easily evaluating how much improvement you really get from consistency, not just performance. How much improvement you get from that. Because when you use web bytes, it's given that you don't lose data with the SSD crashes. Right? And if I use plain web bytes, that means I lose not only all the data that are there, but also additional data which are not consistent. How much is that? That's the question. Right? How much more I'm losing using plain web bytes versus this general web bytes?
On this document, I have a very simple table with some qualitative analysis of this inconsistency.
You can run a simple experiment, you can just crash the SSD, take it away, and you do a FSDK on the sorry.
Count the amount of
you see how much corruption passes using plain web bytes versus all the web bytes. That is the key to the number.
I haven't thought about any quantitative analysis.
But that's what I'm trying to improve, right? That's important.
Yeah. Okay. So in summary, we think that it's important to optimize write accesses. There are three dimensions for caching, performance, fairness, and consistency, but only two current choices, write through and write back, which are very limited in these dimensions. And we a policy that allows us to trade off performance and fairness, which is good. So finally, conclusions and future work. I divided the conclusions per problem. So first, for the duplicated content, we implemented these performance experiments and we observed a substantial reduction, improvement in performance by removing duplication at the buffer cache level. We saw that contention when sharing many applications, when many applications share the same cache, introduced cache wastage. And we saw that wastage, at least for LRU, can be modeled after parameters like seed and flood rate, reuse and flood rate. And well, another one is that wastage increase with the number of workloads. That makes it an important and serious problem with for configured environments. We observe that partitioning can be used to remove duplication. Current techniques for partitioning based on convex wall approaches do not work for out-of-order caches like SSD caches. And finally, we proved experimentally that write-back can be modified to provide early guarantees and still provide close to good write-back performance. That's all for conclusions, and as part of future work, well, first, there is definitely a lot of refinement to do for the last piece of work related to the right policies. Right now, it's pretty much preliminary work. We haven't submitted this yet, but for the other portion of the thesis, pretty much everything submitted and accepted and published. But I still would like to have a deeper understanding of wastage, at least being able to expand this equation and the observation we have to any replacement algorithm. We tried with different replacements, but I don't have a real proof, so I cannot state it with full certainty that this will happen in any case. Also, I see all of these partitioning efforts really, the real solution requires support from the hardware community, specifically for CPU caches. There's no point of doing anything of this until we have some way of actually partitioning the caches to hardware. So the future work I'd like to be working on these things would be to provide the OS support for all these partitioning algorithms and OS changes and things like that. And finally, there are also problems with wastage and contention for caches at the storage size for SANs, for example. But SANs are very limited because they don't have much knowledge about the applications or the guests or anything really. They just see requests with block numbers and reads or writes and maybe some very basic annotations to discussing protocols. But in reality, we need more information, basically process IDs and guests and things like that. And if we assume that we have that, I would like to work more on partitioning on that file and providing a quality of service and things like that. And again, there is more work to be done on the right policy side. Well, as I said, most of this work is published. The duplication thing is published in the IEEE paper in FAS 2010. For modeling cache usage, the ERSS model was published. We have some work for MRC's estimations for L2 and L3 CPU caches. And finally, we wrote a paper for the partitioning of SSD caches, which we submitted maybe 3,000 times and still under review, but hopefully one day we'll get accepted. And well, finally we have some drafts for the last.
Where is that coming into?
EuroSys, ATC.
Currently,
nowhere. Currently, nowhere. Yeah, it's not under revision. Well, it's under revision from the title. Well, this is the list of all my publications, also the ones not related to this dissertation. And, well, I'd like to thank all my thesis collaborators, Raju, Axel from IBM, Ali and Murali from VMware, although Murali is not at VMware anymore. And I'd also like to thank my committee members and my lab mates. Thank you. And thank you all for being here. Thank you.
So, thanks for questions.
So just a question on the partitioning. Do you consider what will be the future? I'm just asking you for possibility. What happens if there is multiple processes out there and if there's a time sharing mode, the adaptive partitioning from a one, it's not going to be static, right?
No, it should adapt.
So is there any overhead and would it be detrimental for partitioning? Will it have any negative effect?
Well, it should have some negative effect, but I wouldn't know until we actually
try it, so that's
what we need much more work in that direction as well. Yeah.
Another question is, if someone writes back, they also have a delayed write operation in memory. Sometimes you keep all these things and accumulate it and sort it and then send it to the write operation. Is a similar thing can be done on that?
Yeah, on SSD caches you have the exact same effect. That's why as you decrease staleness, you start accumulating less and less and less. That's why as you decrease staleness, as we saw in the figure for staleness versus performance versus staleness, you decrease the performance. Yeah. So actually that's the advantage of write back, right? That you overwrite and overwrite to this fast cache.
Do you have any more experiments rather than the reboot time to prove the merit of cache partitioning?
Yes. There are some more experiments related to minimizing latencies, some of latencies. And
using VM workloads, like virtualized workloads?
Yes. And something else that I didn't show is that another use of partitioning is that you can use it for quality of service. Things that as you increase or decrease the size of partitions, you can control the latency of specific applications. Right? So we also have experiments on that side.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Ricardo, your future work about augmenting SAN protocols, forget it, man. That's not going to happen. It's a wasted effort.
Excuse me?
So your future work that you talked about augmenting the SAN storage protocols,
yes.
That's not going to happen. It's a futile task.
Yeah, but at least I know some people that want it to happen. And we saw some paper, I think, in OSDI, OSSP, people proposing what could be augmented. And I don't see why not, for example, EMC owns VMware. They could use whatever protocol they want, right?
No, it's a much, much taller task than that. It's so first of all, the protocol has to be ratified by standards committee. It has to be implemented by, some of the big storage vendors. And the most important part, which is daunting, is that not all storage backends can deal with, the information that you pass. And it depends on what kind of information, but even very basic information that we had asked EMC and NetApp to do, they refuse to do for us, so it's an uphill battle.
Oh. Well, what if EMC starts selling boxes with storage and the hypervisor and everything nicely packaged and without complying with any standard at all? They could sell whatever they want to anybody, right?
Like the
The thing is, I mean, people who cannot afford EMC, you're basically shutting them out, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And but that's what
by not about. Even using VMware. I mean, so right now these are two separate products. So a company that cannot afford EMC can still buy VMware, right? But if you want to package everything together and sell it as a single product, then maybe people won't be able to afford any VMware.
Well, this is beside my dissertation, but I kind of believe that the best way of making money in this business is not necessarily by complying with standards.
Yeah, you have to create a VMware, you start your own company.
For example, I don't know, Apple, Microsoft,
yeah.
They're the most successful companies, but they don't give about standards, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So let's have that discussion.
Yeah.
And have this.
Okay.
About your
but thank you for that. This is the answer from my bosses.
Sure.
From Sarah's fund.
Yeah. So any other questions about Ricardo's dissertation? Okay. So if not, we'll have the audience, the committee members stay here.
Ricardo,
nice
slide.
Thank you.
Nice.
So now it's time for the committee members to ask any final questions to Ricardo, and you know, we should also use this time to give him feedback on his dissertation, on the actual document, and how he can and improve it. So those are the topics for the discussion right now. I mean, if you have any feedback, of course, on the presentation, I'm sure he'll appreciate that as well.
Yeah. So, did any slide for that wastage equation, the dissertation? Do you explain that?
On the physics, yes.
So, actually, about that basis, in the thesis, you have to cache critical application definition, and that thing was very confusing for me. In fact, it defines the wastage in terms of wastage of other applications, and it seemed like a circular definition, so I didn't understand that.
I think I like the way I presented it better. I was thinking about changing it as
okay.
Well. Yeah.
So yeah, I saw
yeah.
That this wasn't here in your presentation.
And that's actually a necessary detail. That was introduced to explain this wastage thing, but I don't think it's necessary. This was enough, right? So
this seems sufficient. The way you want it defined. Because here it seemed like you're defining the wastage of the critical application in terms of the wastage of the other applications, and clearly the wastage of the other applications are also going to be.
Yes.
So it seems like a circular definition of how you're computing other than using some simulated annealing type method. So
really, I mean, to make that suggestion concrete, would you say revisit that description in the context of, or in the same way that was presented today?
Yeah, I think you should go with the definition you have here, with the caveat that you're only dealing with pairwise, what's the right word for it, interference.
Yeah.
You're not dealing with group-wise interference, and therefore the definition is somewhat limited in that sense.
Okay.
So as long as that discussion is there, I think that seems quite reasonable.
Okay.
I agree with you. So I would suggest to revisit some of the definitions you have in this case and make sure that they're precisely defined.
Okay.
And on top of that, sort of give some insights for for the theorems or
you mean some intuition before the
some
from the math? Okay,
sorry.
Yeah, it would help for instance to understand why we use rate plus plug rate is not one.
Right.
So
oh, okay.
That did confuse me for a while. It confused me a lot until I actually saw what you had here.
Okay.
From the definition, I thought they were just complement of each other, and I didn't see why you add both definitions. So I think, again, that little intuition would help. And also, over here, you do talk about an isolation condition, which you sort of didn't mention at all.
That
looked more like an observation than...
It's mainly application of this wasted thing. Right? I mean,
you want to say something more about it?
It's basically, you know, you put these two applications together.
Yeah.
If you want these two applications to run isolated in some sense, not interfering with each other, one way is to partition, another way is to give the extra wastage they need. Right? So this isolation condition is how to calculate this total amount of cache you should give them.
Right. So one of the consequences of that, you say somewhere that the I can find this. I think you say something to the effect that the wastage is as big as the working set of a single workload. That
it can grow to a situation like that. Yeah.
But that contradicts some of the pictures you show where it increases linearly. So these two statements are not consistent.
The thing is that it increases linearly in proportion to the sum of all the working sets.
Yeah, but then it can't be bounded by the workload. So it's not going, it's not growing linearly all the way. That's what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that it's bounded by the size of one block. Okay.
Go to the slide so it's more clear what you're talking about, the slide itself.
Okay. What I wanted to say is that we saw cases that it's as big as the vertices of a workload, but it could be higher.
Then your statement is somewhat misleading because somehow I got the impression that it's bounded by the size of one of them.
No, it's not. We don't know.
Yeah, because the linear behavior suggests that it can just keep going as long as you increase the number of workloads. And that takes a few more than one. So you've got to.
Hi, I have a student here for orientation.
You have a PhD attendant from Dan.
I was told to go to 349 for ETS for orientation.
Trying to over there. We also have a conference room.
I'll rephrase that on the document. I just wanted to show a bad example.
It's actually worse than.
It could be actually worse. Yes.
The linear behavior suggests that it's growing without bounds.
Yes. But that's the worst case I observe experimentally.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about consolidation ratios today, right? 100 to 1 consolidation ratio is not unheard of. Right? 50 to 1 is getting more closer to reality.
Yeah.
And if you stretch that line into 50 or 100, I won't be surprised if your wastage grows to 100%. So you need as much cash for all the wastage as much as you need for your working sets.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the limitation of this framing. We didn't have more.
So, switching to partition, you showed good examples of where it could make things really worse.
Yes.
But what about the reverse case? Aren't there cases where it would actually help? Because you can now use...
You're talking about the convex hull approach, right?
No, I'm so sorry. I guess this example of this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 8.
That's
an example of consolidation that's messing things up.
Yeah.
And you are advocating partitioning. So my question is...
You could.
Consolidation can also help. And why don't you see that aspect of the behavior more than things going right. So
I don't know why, but it seems the working set sizes are more stable than working sets themselves. And maybe that's a consequence of how we code. I don't know, but that's my conclusion after observing why partitioning works.
I think Giri's question is slightly different, if I may rephrase. Can consolidation ever help? I mean, without partitioning, can a consolidated cache help you in some cases? In which case?
Oh, yeah, that would be in the case working sets themselves are stable.
The impression I have is that when one gets worse and the other sort of relaxes, then one could use the space of the other.
Yeah.
Why don't you see that behavior more? Because consolidation says let's not draw boundaries, let's kind of use each other's space as best.
I guess the intuition is that the assumption is that the consolidated virtual machines, they are actually using their working time. They are actually using their position. So that so there's no room for the borrower. But if one virtual machine is not actually using its position, then that share can be borrowed by the other virtual machine and prove that one. Right?
Yeah, but he's seeing the opposite behavior. So we are seeing where consolidation is making things worse, right?
Right. There's all the virtual machines are actually losing their positions, so that there's no room to borrow.
So you're saying it's too tight.
Also, I wanted to say something else. The thing is that you saw the example that the problem was LRU, for example, adapts too quickly to changes in the workers, right? Let me show you that example. You have 3, you have 4, and you push it on top of the stack.
Yeah.
Like that, as quick as that. But maybe the workload would take a bit more longer to adapt to the new working set, right? Mm-hmm. Before actually placing this as really important, you should wait. So partitioning every, let's say, 5 minutes gives us the opportunity of actually waiting and seeing how things are going in the long run. Because it seems that working set sizes are fairly stable. So if we say, let's say, they are completely stable, partitioning will always work, right? Because you find the nice partitioning size, and that has to be equal or better than having full MRC, right?
So also, did you have some evidence for other cache replacement strategies? So for instance, ARC uses. So part of it is also frequency that's messing things up.
Yeah, this, I have 4 lines.
Yeah.
This is ARC. No, sorry, this is LFU with aging.
Yeah.
This is a frequency plus recency. LRU. And also a modification to these two, which is to typically on LRU and LFU, you allocate on demand, right? You miss, you move it to the cache, and you rip. Another approach which is typically used on storage is you do not migrate things from this to the cache on demand, but you migrate them every, let's say, 5 minutes to not interfere with the main I/O file.
How does ARC behave here?
I haven't tested it. Yeah. Yeah, I haven't tested it. But
one of the hypotheses that you had as your final part of your dissertation was to that you wanted to evaluate is that wastage would occur for any cache replacement policy.
Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit more about why you came up with that hypothesis, and that maybe that will help us understand where you're going with this?
This is not at all a formal proof, but I couldn't think of a replacement for which I couldn't find a bad case like this.
Like an adversarial
work. Yeah, like an adversarial work. I know that's not enough, but that's my intuition. That helped me out as an intuition.
I have one more question, if you guys are to jump in, please. So I think this partitioning, you said that this is sort of an open question, how often do you do partitioning?
Yes.
And you have this epoch sort of which has been set to some arbitrary time. Clearly, and you said this is totally arbitrary, it's not clear if that makes sense. But I guess the question is there, how do you pick these, is there a time that you should pick? For instance, if you think of large data services, maybe you have lots of virtual machines and these virtual machines migrate, you're likely to see lots of fluctuations in access for whatever level of, for the cache, let's say, at any level. So should virtual machine migration be something that you should look at when you decide when to repartition or look at EMRCs or something like this?
No, because we observed experimentally that for some workloads, I tried OLTP workloads, and I tried different epochs. 5 minutes was the best one. And I don't think migration will occur every 5 minutes. So I wouldn't leave this partition to migration.
So then the question also is how well does it scale? That was my other question, because all of these are sort of related.
You've obviously
tested it with whatever 20 or 30 reboots, etc. We should do 200 or 20,000, what's it going
to be? I think these epochs should also adapt to the number of VMs. And if you have too many VMs, partitioning too often might hurt the performance too much. So it should depend on the number of VMs, phase changes, and maybe it could be also triggered by some specific user scenarios like migration, so even by application themselves, I don't know, but that's all I can say right now. Yeah, there has to be a better way.
So I think it's still one. I think in ideal case, still 5 minutes is a new test, and then it's a bunch of best one, but I think still it's arbitrary number, it's a static number. Right? And the best scenario is that so the phase should trigger this. And then in between, for example, how you detect the phase change, you need some way to be detect the phase change, then to come up with the right timing for this. And of course, you don't want to partition that often, right? So that's also part of the work. We set a predefined epoch. But when we have pre-trained, we have a bunch of epoch. And I think that's what makes me more adaptive, of course.
Right. That's sort of an obvious trigger, right? I mean, if you suddenly start seeing a lot more misses in one of the VMs, maybe
The thing is that, I mean, my research question was whether partitioning will help or not. Right? Yeah. So if I found some setup where it works, that's answering the question. It helps. I assume better partitioning will help by a much larger factor, but that was enough for me.
So Ricardo, part of the purpose of this session is also, boil down nice items for future work that you can use to make your thesis more complete and richer, right? Yes, it's true that you evaluate hypotheses A, B, and C in your dissertation and you came up with answers, right? But those hypotheses are not the complete story, right? So if someone is reading your dissertation and reading the future work, the best future work chapter would lead to several other dissertations. Right, that you generate, your dissertation generates.
Yeah.
So that's really what we are helping you with here.
Okay.
As well, how can you make that contribution as well? So it's not, I'm not saying that you have to defend yourself, that you haven't done something, but simply to acknowledge what is missing and what is important.
Okay. Yeah, I'm always finding it difficult to you know when to defend my order, when to say, okay, it's time.
No, I think, no, well, first of all, a defense strategy for something that you haven't done is completely flawed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you just haven't done it. There's no reason for you to defend it.
Okay.
If the word says, okay, what you're doing is not correct or wrong or it seems wrong, then you defend it. But if someone is saying, okay, you have addressed this but haven't addressed this, then the right strategy would be to acknowledge and the importance of that extension.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, that's right.
I have one question. So how did you use the e-filing trace? This trace is tracked from web server or mail server, and how do you use them to simulate a consolidated
For that experiment, it was just replaying first individually, like with using a cache emulator, just a cache emulator, and then for the replaying of everything consolidated at the same time, I use timestamps to put them in the correct place.
Oh,
use
timestamps.
Yeah.
Okay. But
that's not realistic.
So you're saying that just trying to understand this from the future I can also use it. So you use the mail server and you assume that one virtual machine? And they assume the browser is not a working machine?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the addresses don't have timestamps?
Yes.
And then you have your...
I sort by timestamp, they hope.
Yes, different together, different timestamps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In reality, you could have different behaviors, right? One could be, halting the other one or consuming most of the resources of the other one.
If you have timestamps in the traces, at least Intel router times are really sick.
Yeah, at least that. Yeah.
The only question is how to mix them.
Yeah.
So there's one thing that I'd like to kind of have you address, and that is many of your chapters are joint work. Maybe you could say something about what others have contributed to the chapters. I assume they are primarily your efforts, so it would be nice to know what they have contributed.
So you're saying in the initial acknowledgement section, you could say that this work was done in collaboration. So certain chapters were done in initial part of the thesis.
That's what I have my students do. I have them at the beginning of a chapter say that this work was published jointly with Ryan Lau. And something about what they contributed in terms of...
Like the first paragraph of every chapter?
Yeah, or even towards the end, it doesn't really matter.
I think the nicer way is to have it right up front in the
acknowledgement chapter or in the
acknowledgement part, right, where you acknowledge different people and
okay.
Say that certain works were done in collaboration.
Because, here, I'm assuming that you were the driving force for many of the projects, so... it would be good to sort of acknowledge where the others contributed.
Yeah. I think that's that. Yes. For example, for the Westlake team, we have several meetings with Akshar and IBM, so that idea really came up from both together meetings.
So it
should be up there to take it on.
Murali, do you have any questions or suggestions?
So I pointed out a few issues that Ricardo could look at. One is, how do you achieve those right ordering guarantees in the presence of disk array snapshots? And then the other is, how do you do right ordering in the presence of communicating applications on separate virtual machines? Another suggestion I had is, I don't know if it will help, but typically all these asynchronous replication schemes, they model the staleness as a parameter called RTO or RPO, recovery time objective or recovery point objective. I guess, if you model write back staleness as an RTO or an RPO objective, does that help you get a more smoother spectrum? Because, you know, we, I guess one of the points that Ricardo made in his slides was that, you know, we need a more, a policy where things can be tweaked or controlled along the dimensions of performance, consistency, and staleness. That's something to maybe think about. I don't know if that will help or not, though. And finally, the one thing I'll be really interested in is the latency controls that Ricardo brought up. In other words, how do you control the reservations automatically? Because one of the biggest problems with VMware's DRS reservation shares and limit schemes is that, you know, it's black magic. I mean, nobody knows. No real admin knows what an application's working set is and all that. It's just too arcane and too cumbersome to use. And so, on the other hand, people understand latencies, or they definitely understand latency guarantees. And so I think it's a holy grail. Like, there's absolutely no storage product that's out there which does automatic storage latency guarantees. So if this work can be extended to solve that problem, I think it will be a pretty significant contribution.
And when you say guarantees, you mean probabilistic guarantees, right?
Yeah. I mean, especially in a scenario where you don't control the SAN storage, you know, we cannot give any absolute guarantees. So it has to be probabilistic, like, let's say, you know, 99th percentile or something like that, latencies to that effect. And so, in other words, I think it's fine if you, like, one of the things he brought up was, like, minimizing overall system latency. I think that's a fine goal, too. But I think people more, they care more about relative latencies, like, across different classes of virtual machines or different classes of workloads. They have a gold tier where, you know, you want latencies less than 0.5 milliseconds 90% of the time, and a silver tier for 1 millisecond. You know, different classes of that kind. I don't think it's that important to minimize overall system latency.
Okay. Okay.
So, but anyway, the point is that, you know, the latency controls is, and that too in the presence of an SSD is a very good goal to try and achieve. I don't think there are any products out there to do that.
Do you have that picture for latency control?
I can open the paper.
You also have, I think, a presentation. So the only thing is that Murali cannot see any of this.
Oh.
Yeah.
He has a copy of the presentation, so he could look at whatever he wants.
Yeah, but this is the...
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello. Murali, can you open up Ricardo's dissertation?
Actually, I only have the slides. Ricardo didn't send me the dissertation.
No, I did it.
Sent a while ago.
I sent it
about two weeks ago.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize there was an attachment on that. So, okay, give me 1 second. Let me open it up.
Maybe the file was too large and didn't go through.
Yeah, let me check. 1 sec.
So in any case, Ricardo, in the meanwhile, I mean, after you pull up the graph, you can describe what that graph tells you.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you have an example where one does better than the other.
And
the latency related.
No, actually, I didn't include this on the dissertation because I focused on the portion of the system that eliminates consistency issues. So I saw latency, specific latency controls as not part of this overall problem.
So the dissertation
doesn't have specific latency controls.
But in recent that there was some discussion about latency related analysis. So
yeah, there is one that minimizes the sum of latency, but Murali is talking about controlling specific VMs latency.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. So this is page 69 in hedge fund stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the latency curve, getting the latency curve itself shows you that.
That is true. Yeah.
You were pointing. You had that on this slide.
You mean this equation, right? How I control the electricity?
Yeah, you could talk about that equation if you want. But I was looking at the chart, at the graph, where you had this as an example of a latency curve.
Oh, an example of a latency curve, yeah. This one?
Yeah, that one. So that's on page 82.
Yeah.
Or 69.
Oh, it's 82 around the title.
But probably it's the figure 5.7.
Yeah. So, Murali, were you able to look at the dissertation or?
Yeah, I am. I'm looking at it. So, around page 70, I think, is where he talked about the
figure 5.7.
Okay.
So here your goal is to minimize the sum of the latencies.
Yes.
Or total latency.
Yes.
But you could use the same graph to talk about controlling latency. And in the paper you actually had a different plot.
Yeah.
You don't have it here.
I don't have it here. Basically, let's say you have, let's see, sub figure A for figure 5.7. Let's say you're seeing at the random workload.
They're both A?
Yeah. Oh, okay, the first A. things that, let's say the latency limit is 3 milliseconds. So this will give this application a cache size of more than 5 gigabytes. That's basically what it does.
Right. So
the observation, sorry, go ahead.
The point being that you can construct these latency curves and use the size of the cache to control what is the minimum latency or maximum latency that the workload will see.
Yeah, the main reason you can do that is that latency versus space monotonically decreases. So you can't find a space for which you have the latency you want.
So Murali had a bunch of pointers for future work as well, and I think one other thing that you mentioned, Murali, was application level consistency versus file system level consistency.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to include. I don't know if write through by default preserves application level consistency. I think it does.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Right. So I think it's important to address that. Whereas these new write back, ordered, and journal do not automatically preserve that application level consistency.
That's correct.
So I think it's important to talk about that in future work as well.
Okay.
One question I have is why is chapter 7 at the end? That seems related, but somehow it seems a part of it earlier. You're having a defense right now. You call the one to the front.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think that if you call.
Yeah. So chapter 7 seems to include previous work and also comparison of your work with previous work. So in that sense, it makes sense to have it there. But then it makes sense to have previous work described a little bit earlier in order to put your work in context. So I'm not that comfortable with that being over at the end.
Well, one approach I could move it at the beginning and move the the discussion of the comparisons
in
each of the chapters.
Yeah, that's what I would suggest, but again, up to you guys how you want to do it.
I mean, if there is a strict preference, then we are okay to go with that. I'm okay either way.
So I have to say that the dissertation reads very well, it flows very well, and we have a lot of discussion throughout the material, and that's great. That's why having these pointers to previous work at the end seemed to sort of defeat the purpose. It would have been great to have that a little bit earlier, or strewn around the chapter. I wanted it to.
Okay. I can do that easily, because there's also the problem that on the related work I'm using some terms that I define on the chapters themselves.
Right.
So it could be a...
I understand. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
But maybe you could just put it into the chapters.
Yeah, okay.
Have a little section on related work within each chapter.
Okay. Okay, that's easy.
Because otherwise, you know, the way you build your stuff flows very well.
Okay. I'll move it to every chapter. That's straightforward. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I think that's a good idea.
So, Raju and Ricardo, I have a few comments on the actual thesis write-up. Maybe I'll just email it to you. There are a few things that are, I guess, maybe it needs to be either addressed or removed in the write-back section.
Okay,
yes, certainly, and that's true for everyone, which is if you have specific comments for the dissertation, send it to Ricardo. The only thing is that he has not too much time, a little less than 10 days to submit the final version to Rajat. So if you can send your comments earlier, that would help ensure that all of it is incorporated into the final version.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, please.
So Ricardo, as I see it, you're the related work and maybe some of the comments that Murli is going to write to you. And then substantial expansion of the feature work section is what remains to be done.
And also I'll revisit the web stage.
Revisit the base stage description and make it simpler, more in line with what you talked about today.
Okay. Yeah,
I think those are the four main things.
Yeah.
Okay. And so after you're done with all this, you will forward your dissertation again to the committee members for final signatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, just step out for a couple of minutes. I think we should.
Okay.
So, what did everyone think about? Ricardo is not has left the room, so you can have a free discussion about what your opinion is on the work. The main question is the work good enough for a PhD? Is there agreement on that, or are there any questions?
Yeah,
okay, so I don't hear any objections. That's good. And are there any other things that you want to say that you might not have said before in Ricardo's presence? Okay. So yeah, I think the thesis is great. In fact, I would have been okay to approve the work that he did even last year. I mean, excluding the right policies work. Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, it's more than good enough. For a PhD dissertation. Did you have something to say?
No, I thought it was very well written and well presented.
All right, great. So thank you very much for serving, and you'll hear from Ricardo. Thanks, Murali.
No problem. Thank you, guys.
Okay, I'll hang up now.
Can you, I guess I'll call Ricardo on his cell phone or something.
I can bring him back in if you want to chat with him briefly. I'll bring him back in.
No, I just wanted to wish him and,
Oh, okay. Yeah, one second. I'll bring him back.
Yeah.
Ricardo? Congratulations. Well done.
Thank you.
And Murli, congratulations.
Hey, Ricardo?